G'day Audiophiles. Coming up on this episode, our featured guest is going to be director, actor and writer Helen Goldwyn. We're going to be delving into her career pre-Big Finish and everything that she's done with Big Finish too. We can't possibly cover everything, but we'll cover a lot of the major stuff. We're also going to be talking about what we've been listening to. Philip's been listening to some of the latest Big Finish that's out there. And I've been listening to something a little bit different, something from Magic Bullet. When we jump down the rabbit hole, Philip and I are going to be talking about some of the dream franchises that we would love Big Finish to take on if they ever were able to acquire the license. And we'll give you a little debrief of the Sophie Aldred live event that happened last weekend in Sydney. Plus, we'll give you a little teaser of what is to come for the Sirens of Audio live events. There is more. Stick around. G'day Audiophiles, this is the Sirens of Audio, the show that explores the universe of Doctor Who in the audio medium. I'm Dwayne.
And I'm Philip. G'day Dwayne, g'day Audiophiles.
G'day Philip, how are you today?
I am a bit cold, I've put a jump on for the first time.
I know, it's getting cold here in Australia, isn't it? We are doing this during daylight again. What's the matter with us?
Oh, I
know. Are we becoming old men all of a sudden?
I've just taken a flex day, so I had some time. And I've been out every night this week, for goodness sake, so I needed some, couldn't find any other time.
Well, we've got some great stuff coming up on the show, but let's do a little debrief of last weekend. What was happening in our world, Philip?
What was happening in our world? We had Sophie Aldred come to an event in Sydney. So, more than 100 people there and just had a marvellous, fantastic time. The feedback has been so exciting. That's been the best part, I think, just hearing some wonderful things from people.
And just watching people's faces on the day, there were so many young fans, which is what amazed me. Did you expect to see quite so many young people there?
I think
younger fans?
I think after the Janet event, yes. I wasn't sure until we had the Janet event, but there's lots of young fans at Janet, and then there's even more at Sophie. Those younger fans, it sounded like they're very much into the classic series too. It wasn't just because of the power of the Doctor they came. They came because they love classic Doctor Who. And it was just the mingling that was happening. There was friendships being formed. It was very much like the old days, Dwayne, when fans got together. There's all these new relationships forming and people changing phone numbers. And, we were so blessed to have a Dalek come.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yes, Aaron, well done. So, yeah, just one of the guys, decided to make a Dalek for the day and brought it up. All off his own bat. It was, and it was just wonderful to have it there. It became a real talking point and, people were gathering around the Dalek and having photos. And Sophie was just amazing with the guests as always. And just, getting alongside people and chatting with people and people were sharing things.
And what a lovely person. She truly is a great ambassador for Doctor Who, old series and new series.
Yeah, she really is. What I can truly say about, and this is all the Doctor Who cast that that are involved in doing conventions and traveling the circuit, is that they really do care about the fans and doing the best for them at all times.
Yeah.
And even though, sometimes some pretty kind of rude questions get asked to them or other comments get made, they always take everything with a smile, but they're just always there.
And they've heard it all before anyway.
Well, yes, maybe. You mean the rude comments?
Yes.
Yeah.
They've heard it all before.
Yeah. I don't really like you as a companion, but when?
And I made one comment while I was on stage with Sophie about Big Finish. Actually, I might put that little clip in here now.
But he would just give a little something different each time. And Janet and I just kept turning to each other and going, oh, he's a good actor. You just know when somebody's a good actor. It's funny, you can't put it into words, really. Same like when I met David Tennant for the first time. You just know. It's an incredible feeling. It's really great.
And let's not forget, Ace has also met Jeffrey Beaver's master on Big Finish.
So, yes,
beautiful voice there, that's great. It could be more than so. And Big Finish is canon, of course. That's my.
So I was very chuffed to hear the audience reaction to my comment that Big Finish was canon. I was a little bit shocked. I didn't expect to get applause about that. So there's more Big Finish listeners than I thought.
There is. And yeah, there's lots of Big Finish listeners out there. And I agree to, yeah, I've always said it was canon. Yeah, if you listen to the Jason Hay Gallery questions a couple of weeks ago, we released. He was asked the question, is Big Finish canon? He was very, oh, it's up to you.
But now diplomatic.
He's diplomatic. It's canon. Let's face it. The BBC think it's canon. Most of it. I mean, there's bits of that deliberately not canon because they're exploring other things. It's educational, like the latest release that's just come out in terms of the re-release of the Ark in Space they've just put out? The new version of that. And
the Ark, yeah.
The Ark, so the original version. I mean, that's not canon, but that's just in terms of exploration and education in terms of what we could have had. Looking forward to hearing that. I haven't heard it yet, but yes.
Very good.
What else are the highlights for you, Dwayne?
Oh, highlights? Yeah, just seeing all the fans' reactions to things and just the down-to-earth. Like, both Janet and Sophie were really down-to-earth, beautiful, warm people. Different personalities, of course. They've got some interesting differences in personality, but both beautiful people.
Yeah. So just what other things. Lots of people are saying, will we keep doing them? Is there more to come?
Yeah.
And both of these two kind of fell in our laps. Well, Janet contacted me and said she wanted to do it, and then she said, oh, Sophie's doing one too. And so these two both sort of fell in our laps.
Yeah.
And so I really wasn't sure at the time whether or not it would be something to do. But we're not saying who yet, but we do actually have the next guest lined up. So believe it or not, there is another one coming up before the end of the year.
And we are going to have a few months break, but it will be happening before the end of the year. So that should be very exciting. So stay tuned for all that news. Mm. All right. Let's get on to the next segment of our show. We should probably talk about our recommendations. Now, what I'd like to recommend... Oh, no, I can't, Philip. You know why I can't do that.
Why is
that? Because it's your turn.
Great. Right. I'm going to recommend the first in the Once and Future set. I think people, hopefully you all know, it's the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who coming up this year.
Is it?
It is. In November 23rd. And Big Finish to Celebrate is bringing out, I forget how many, is it nine stories?
Eight.
Eight stories.
Seven this year and one next year.
I wonder why that's the one next year. What
strange,
does that mean?
Isn't it?
But, it is strange. Yeah. So anyhow.
I'm sure it'll all make sense in the end.
I'm sure it'll all make sense. So it still doesn't make sense to me particularly, but I'm looking forward to it making sense. But the first release came out last month. It's the Tom Baker and Sadie Miller. So it's Fourth Doctor and Sarah. Kind of. Have you listened to it yet?
I have.
You have. So in fact, all Doctors appear in the first episode, not for very long, more just cameos.
Yep.
It's an intriguing way that they've started.
So interesting idea, isn't it?
Interesting idea.
It's not been done before. It's nice to get something that hasn't been done before.
It's actually something similar. There was a comic strip story very, very early on in Doctor Who magazine, which had a similar concept from 30 years back or more. And so it is actually something that I had thought about before. And so it looks like a clever way of storytelling.
We can spoil that bit because I think it's in the blurbs, but there is a degeneration aspect, and that's how the Doctor gets to revisit past lives. But my question is, who is the Doctor that actually is there in the first place that does the degeneration? Which Doctor is it?
Well, that's true. So anyhow, we come in with him degenerating backwards and forwards through different regenerations, and finally kind of settles on Fourth Doctor, and we have an adventure with him. So I'm really intrigued to see where these eight CDs take us to, how it's planned out. I still really have no idea where it's going, which is curious, but I'm looking forward to it. But first one out, and I suspect the 60th anniversary specials, it's a must really for Big Finish fans. But I'm looking forward to the next one this month, which I'm not even sure when that comes out or who's in it. Has it been released?
I can't remember who it is either. It could be a Fifth Doctor story. I'm not sure. But that would be too logical, wouldn't it?
Possibly.
Go from fourth to fifth?
Maybe. All my attentions have been fairly strongly focused on other things for the last couple of weeks.
As it should have been too. You did a great job, should I say. And thank you so much for having so many kids, because without your kids, we would have been staffed, I reckon.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I have been listening to is an interesting little sidestep I've been taking back. I saw a post from Alan Stevens, the man behind Magic Bullet Productions, who did the Caldor City series.
They're great.
And it's been a long time since I listened to the Faction Paradox series that he did. So I've started re-listening to that. Boy, it's good. The quality of Caldor City was so good, and they've matched that quality again with Faction Paradox. However, Faction Paradox being a book sort of created universe by Lawrence Miles that was done during the books, it was never something that I knew much about, and it's still something that confuses me a little bit because they talk about the great houses, which are all the chapter houses of the Time Lords, but they never say Time Lord. And Faction Paradox is one of these houses that, does kind of crazy things. A bit like an out-of-control CIA, I guess. And the series that Magic Bullet did also involves the Osirens. So it's got Gabriel Wolfe as Sutek, with also other characters being played by Philip Maddock, Julian Glover, Peter Miles is in there. And so we got some interesting scenes in the Osiren court, or on the Osiren ship called the Ship of a Billion Years. That's the name of one of the stories. And so with the factions' time all being intertwined with the timelines of the Osirens, we get some interesting things happening with Sutek, and it's just fascinating stuff. I still haven't got my head all around it, but the production is amazing, and it's wonderful to hear these voices. Many of them aren't with us anymore, like Philip Maddock and Gabriel Wolfe in particular. Wonderful. So that's what I'd recommend. Go to caldorcity.com and you can grab Faction Paradox.
I've seen it around for years and years and never listened to it, so yeah.
Actually, BBV did the first six, and I think for some reason the rights went from BBV to Caldor or Magic Bullet, but they sort of don't step on each other. They sort of, Magic Bullet continues on to a degree of where the BBV ones left off, but they're a kind of a different production style altogether. And it's been so long since I've heard the BBV ones too. I must listen to them again. But I decided to start with Caldor City because, you never know if I like it. We might have to do something about it. Philip, for the podcast.
Oh, dear. More listening.
More to listen to. We can always do a... Because you weren't on the podcast when I did a little retrospective of Caldor City. So it might be good to nut that out between the two of us.
Yeah, which I wouldn't mind because I think, part of the reason I enjoyed your podcast so much and got in contact was because of Caldor City, which
yep.
I just love. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant series.
It is. It is. It's one of the unsung heroes of Doctor Who-related audio, that's for sure. All right, that's my recommendation. One more thing to do before we bring on our special guest for this episode, Helen Gulwin. Do you know what that is?
No, what's that, Dwayne?
We have to jump down the rabbit hole. Let's go.
We've got up again.
I wasn't pointing. No. I wasn't pointing down the rabbit hole. I was saying, let's go. Let's go. That's what the upward finger is all about. I've spoiled that now for everyone. It's lost its joke value now. All right. So my rabbit hole top question today is, because I'm very excited about a forthcoming guest that we've got, because the guest that's coming up very soon appeared in a television series that's, well, not related to Doctor Who very much, very, very loosely related to Doctor Who, but her first television was in that series. So I want to know, Philip, if Big Finish took on another franchise, what would your dream franchise for Big Finish be?
I mean, my dream shows from back in the highlight of BBC times, I mean, one of them would be Tenko.
Okay.
So... I mean, I don't know how much the cast would still be alive now because they're all rapidly...
Well, they could recast it. They could recast it and do it just like they've done with Callan and the Avengers.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, actually, you're right. They could too. So, yeah, so Tenko, I think, was just an amazing series that explored women in the lives of prisoner of war camps during the Second World War with Japan. And that was just a show that was just absolutely brilliant and I enjoyed all the time. So something like that would be great.
Would it sell though? Because
no, it wouldn't sell. So you're asking okay. what I'd like. You're not asking me what would sell.
Okay, all right.
I mean, in terms of selling, no, it probably wouldn't sell at all.
Right.
But then, nothing that moves far outside the Doctor Who range sells much. Though, can I say I was so excited to see there's more Omega Factor coming, because the Omega Factor, which also starred Louise Jameson during the early '80s. That was a brilliant, terrifying show, scared the life out of me as a kid, and still makes me uncomfortable as an adult. When they brought that, I think they did 3 seasons of that originally, and then it wasn't selling well enough, so they decided not to make any more. So to hear that they're doing another one is fantastic news. So obviously over time, enough have sold, and that's part of Big Finish's dilemma, is that they have a huge hit run of buying when it first comes out, and then it sort of trickles down. And so things like, I think the Frobisher ones didn't sell particularly, like the Holy Terror didn't sell well at all when it first came out. But now it actually has made lots of money for them. And so sometimes it's just about that trickle down waiting effect. I mean, I don't understand it all, and it's business models that I don't understand, and we aren't being told naturally how it all works. Like we don't get told how many units they're selling usually. I mean, we do know there's 1,500 of the Blake 7 box set that they've released. That hasn't sold out yet. But usually we don't actually know how many they produce, how many they sell, because that's, rightly so, that's business matters that none of our business.
So what else would you like them to take on for you?
What else would I like them to take on for me? So I got distracted, didn't I? I'd love more goodies in terms of comedy. I don't know. Well, you've obviously thought about it. What are you thinking about?
Well, the guest that we've got coming up was her first television was The Tripod. So it has been mentioned by many fans of the TV series that Big Finish could very nicely do a reimagining of The Tripods. I would love to see it. I think you're a little bit older, so you didn't get onto The Tripods train when it first started, did you, Philip? So, and I know that Nick Briggs...
Was it ABC? What was
no, Channel
on?
7.
Oh, see, I just didn't watch Channel 7.
Because Channel 7 was a co... whatever they were, co-producer.
Yeah, no, I was just a television snob. I would watch Channel 7.
Yeah, but it was absolutely incredible for me at the time as a teenager. But I know Nick Briggs, he hates it. So it's not going to happen.
No.
and I also think the rights, after talking with one of the guys who was in The Tripods, I did an interview for the Nerdology podcast. Actually, Jim Baker, the guy who played Henry, I did an interview with him a few years ago, and I'll put a link in the show notes actually for that episode if you want to hear me chatting with Jim Baker. He mentioned that Disney has the rights to The Tripods, and they sometimes buy up rights for things and just so that they can't be made. Nice. They have no intention of making it, but they've got the rights so they can just sit on them. I think Nick Briggs doesn't like it because he thinks it's a ripoff of War of the Worlds, which in some ways it is, but in other ways it isn't. I think you can make it interesting enough so that it's dissimilar enough to War of the Worlds to make it a really entertaining series. And so that's one for me. What else? I was looking over YouTube, and you can actually see Moonbase 3, which was the series that I think Terrence Dix and Barry Letts made around 1973. Do you remember that series?
I know of it just through fan stuff. I've never seen it.
I was watching a bit of it, and it was just like same production values, same sets, same incident. It's Dudley Simpson's incidental music from around that period. So you're looking at season 9 type music, and really interesting. So I wonder if, that's ever been considered by Big Finish to do something like that. It would be interesting, I think, because it's related enough to Doctor Who that Doctor Who fans might buy it too. So that could be something they could do. But they've done similar stuff with Star Cops. So, the sort of alternate science fiction type scene might be something that they've already saturated. So, yeah. So those two could be good.
I mean, Jason Hegg-Ellery did announce at Brisbane that they've just acquired the rights to something very special, but he wouldn't say what it was. So there'll be an announcement coming out soon in terms of what that program is they've got the rights to. So that could be exciting. I mean Star Trek, I'd love to see Deep Space Nine continue or something like that. Would be wonderful as well. But once again, American shows and rights would be very hard to get.
Yeah. Even anthology stuff like, you know, Twilight Zone type stuff, or there was a show recently called Electric Dreams, which was based on the short stories of Philip K. Dick. I think something like that in audio form would be really cool as well. I would certainly get that. But whether it would be a hit with fans and whether it would sell, I guess that's the question for Jason, isn't it, to consider. But, yeah, Tripods would be my number one. You can fully recast it. With something like Star Trek, you'd expect to get some of the actors over who were in it. But something like Tripods, you could fully recast from scratch. There you go.
Okay.
All right. Let's crawl up out of the rabbit hole and we'll bring on our special guest, Helen Goldwood. Now, I've got to say, before we bring Helen on, Philip, Helen has got to be one of the biggest unsung heroes in the entire history of Big Finish. Would you agree?
Yeah, I do. I her talent in terms of a performer and actress, I find it bizarre she hasn't had a huge, huge career, because she's so talented in terms of comedy, drama, singing, dancing. She really, she's everything that should be huge. And I just think, I can't believe she's not a huge, huge star, because she certainly deserves to be. But Big Finish has been blessed by getting her talent, because yeah, the amount of shows she's done, she's now writing, directed. I can't imagine Big Finish without her.
Yeah, absolutely. And she was in your favourite audio adventure of all time, wasn't she?
She was.
So Doctor Who and the Pirates, we might briefly mention it, but we're not going to mention it in great detail. The reason for that is it's just gone 20 years since Doctor Who and the Pirates has been released, and we are going to put together a special feature just on Doctor Who and the Pirates, and that'll be coming very soon. So that'll be something very good to look forward to. So if we don't mention too much about the Pirates in the interview with Helen, fear not, we have, and we'll be including that bit in our Doctor Who and the Pirates show. So what was Helen's first appearance in Big Finish? Do you recall?
Yeah, so the first time Helen was in Big Finish was Suspect of Lanyon Moore, where she played, I think, three or four different characters and died horribly in all of them.
She does that very well. She's awesome.
But lots of different accents. I think she's Spanish, she's English, she's something else. So, yeah, lots of death.
All right. Let's throw in a trailer for The Spectre of Lanyon Moore, and then we'll be back with Helen Goldwyn.
Doctor Who, The Spectre of Lanyon Moore.
Up the airy mountain, down the rushy glen.
Stefan, you have deserted me!
We daren't go a-hunting for fear of little men.
No, do not leave me!
Some external force interfering with the orientation circuits. We've been drawn off course.
I've heard that one before.
Ah, Mr. Ludgate, still enjoying the new toy?
Definitely some sort of electrical activity up on the moor.
I don't suppose the Brigadier has put in an appearance this morning?
Lethbridge Stewart, you old rogue, how are you?
I'm extremely well, thank you.
Professor!
Ah, Sir Archibald, good morning. You know the Brigadier, don't you?
Yes, we've met. Morning, Brigadier.
Morning, sir.
Any news on the Spectre of Lanyon Moore?
The what?
All of this is Lanyon Moore, right across to Tremaine, 5 miles that-a-way.
Dusk is approaching and night falls very quickly on the moor. There's quite a mist rising, so do make sure you stay on the path, won't you?
No!
Well, it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to Sirens of Audio the amazing and wonderful Helen Goldwyn. Helen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Lovely to be back.
It's been a year since we spoke to you, so my apologies, because I've been wanting to talk to you for so long. Last time we spoke was just before the 8th of March, and that last big release, we were talking about that. But we've been keen to get you back to talk a lot more about the broader range of all that you've done, because you've been with Big Finish now for more than 20 years and doing an amazing range. You come up with 159 search results in Big Finish when I look you up. And that doesn't include a lot of stuff I know that you've also done that's not listed. So, firstly, amazing contributions. But I actually want to start a bit earlier than that. I want to talk about in terms of why did you decide to become an actress in the first place?
Well, I don't think it's something I decided. And I would always say this to young people who want to go into the business. It was something that was just completely innate and was a necessity. It just wasn't ever debatable that that's what I was. And so therefore, that's how I was going to earn my living or not, as the case may be. So, yeah, I don't recall making a decision. I just always knew that's what I was.
So were you doing lots of theatre at school? What was the sort of the progress of how did you become the performer that you are?
Well, interestingly, I think I'm a bit unusual because I'm relatively sort of comparatively reserved in comparison to most theatre kids. I'm a massive show off on stage, but I don't like attention off stage. And so I wasn't a precocious stage school kid, even though I went to stage school. I kind of flew under the radar quite a lot. I ended up at stage school really more because my mum was being a taxi service. I was going to classes after school every day. I was doing all the different dance styles, mainly dance, actually. And I was doing once a week drama class at a place called Lane Theatre Arts. And then I had an assessment with my local council because my parents didn't know what to do with me. That's right. I got into an academic school and I revolted and said I wasn't going. And so they had me assessed. And the people at the council on the arts board said, send her to a stage school. And if she gets in, we'll give her a bursary. So that's what happened.
So what styles of dance can you do?
Well, I trained in a very focused way. I had professional dance training from the age of 12 to 19, and I did mainly ballet initially, 3 hours of dance a day, and as well as our academic stuff. And I also was very proficient in tap and jazz dance and modern and contemporary and pretty much all the styles. And then very rarely used it in my subsequent career, frustratingly.
Yeah. You've also got a lovely singing voice. I've watched some different videos of you, some YouTube stuff, and I've actually seen some of the stuff you've released privately. So did you study song as well?
Yes. So I did 4 years at ballet school, and then I went straight on to the same school, Arts Educational. I did 3 years on the musical theatre course, but I'd already started singing in school. I was already a soprano, sort of quite classical singer by the age of 16. And then I did a more musical theatre style from 16 to 19. And I'm still learning now. I've just gone back to singing lessons again to learn a more of a pop style of singing to add to my repertoire, really. So you never stop learning.
Oh, no, that's for sure. So when you left school, what sort of happened? How did... It's always hard to have a career in acting, and you know, I think I heard recently there's three times as many women as men going in the profession, and yet there's the reverse for number of parts for women to men. So what was your hope, and you know, in terms of what's your highlights?
I had some amazing highlights at the start of my career, but I got off to a very inauspicious start because we didn't. Nowadays at theatre school, at colleges, you would have an agent showcase. At the end of the three-year course, you would invite all the agents, you'd do your best speech and your best song, and you'd try and get an agent. We didn't have that in my day. We did have a few agents come to the end of year show, but I wasn't in that show. I'd chosen to just focus on my dance classes and not be in the show. So I left college one of the few. Having had a very successful time at college, I was one of the few that didn't have an agent. So for the first 10 months, I was in absolute turmoil, out in the wilderness, couldn't get an audition, couldn't get an agent. And it was all horrifically awful. And then a marvelous thing happened because one of my teachers from college remembered me and had suggested me for an audition for a production of Uncle Vanya, which was being produced by Kenneth Branagh's theatre company, Renaissance Theatre Company.
Okay, yep.
And Kenneth Branagh was co-directing with Peter Egan. And it was also starring Richard Briers as Uncle Vanya.
Wow.
And so I understudied all three women in that show, the two kind of younger female leads and Vanya's mother at the age of 19. And I was also the ASM, the assistant stage manager. So that's how a lot of people used to get their equity cards. But I was in a very unusual position. I trained as a dancer and as a singer, and then I'd got my first job with Kenneth Branagh's acting company. So it was pretty amazing.
What was Kenneth like?
Amazing. Oh, my God. I mean, the most articulate person I think I've ever met. Charming, funny, brilliant, very all-encompassing. You know, I didn't feel left out, even though I was the little ASM understudy. Yeah, it was an amazing experience all round. And Richard Briers was an absolute delight. He's, you know, a national treasure here. And he used to call me Little Darling. So we'll make sure the Little Darling doesn't get left out.
So how long was that job for?
That was a four-month national tour. It might have been a bit longer, actually. It might have been 6 months. And then I went pretty much straight into another big tour doing My Fair Lady, understudying again, which was, sadly, I was much too useful as an understudy because I had vocal versatility. I think most people who get into leading roles are known for sounding a particular way and looking a particular way. And I was always a character actor and a character singer, and I could look lots of different, like I was lots of different things. And so I was eminently useful as someone who could cover all the female leads. So that's what happened to me a lot at the start of my career.
Which is both good, but also bad.
Oh, I found it awful after a while. In fact, the change in my career started when I turned down a very big job in Fiddler on the Roof. Actually, it was the last time that Topol did the tour of Fiddler on the Roof. And I had pushed and pushed for an audition, thinking I'm perfect for one of the daughters. And then I got understudy to one of the daughters. And I just thought, I can't do this for a year. I can't be in the background watching someone else play the part I want to play. So I turned it down and my agent dumped me.
Wow. They wanted their regular income.
Yeah, they couldn't believe that I would do that. Yeah, because it was an international tour and going in the West End, and you know, on paper it looked perfect, but I knew I couldn't cope with it. So that's when I became a writer. I started writing to justify that decision.
Now, you've done a lot of comedy work as well. How would you classify? How would you categorize yourself then as an artist?
I have struggled a lot with this over the years. But somebody, and it might even have been you guys, somebody came up with the word polymath. And I love that word. And I love that I can officially define myself as no one thing. I am a creative polymath. Anything you throw at me in terms of creativity, I feel very confident that I can excel at it. So whether that's singing or dancing or acting or producing or directing or choreographing or musical directing or composing and even designing costumes, I did costume design at A-level or art, all those things are my things. And I don't embark upon anything unless I think I'm going to be brilliant at it.
I was actually going to bring that up, actually, because a lot of the clips that I've seen of you recently outside of Big Finish are comedy pieces.
Yes.
So whereas your Big Finish stuff is very, very powerful, very dramatic stuff. Is there a style you prefer? Do you prefer comedy or one over the other, or you like to have that variety?
I think the thing that sets me apart as a performer really is that fundamentally I am a comedic. I have a comedic sensibility. I would always say that's my thing that I can do better than other people. There are lots of people that can do dramatic roles, and of course I love doing those. But it's something extra to have comedy timing and comedy rhythm and just a feel for comedy. Not everyone can do that, and I love, you know, that aspect of a part of what I do, you know, that it's all tied into musicality as well. Everything I do is an expression of music, as I think I've said before, that everything is about the rhythm and the feel and the dynamics, and that ties in very well with comedy.
How do you deal with the social aspect of being an actor, and then contrast that with the sort of isolation of a writer? How do you deal with those? They're sort of almost opposite ends of the spectrum, aren't they?
They are, but then very conveniently, so am I, because I love to be around people and I feed off people's energy. And then I'll hit a wall where I think I don't want anyone to talk to me anymore and I don't want to have to make an effort and interact. I need time to recalibrate and re-energize. So I'm not, as I said, a massive natural extrovert. And so being holed away and not having to interact is actually quite healthy for me up to a point. I mean, there does come a point if I'm doing lots of writing where I start to feel a bit lonely. But in general, I really enjoy not having to be on show. You know, it's good to have a mix of the two, definitely.
There's so much more I'd love to talk about with you, Korean, but we'll move to Big Finish stuff if you don't mind. Firstly, sure. How did you come to work for Big Finish?
I was very good friends with Barnaby Edwards. We'd done a production of Macbeth together, and I had been feeling quite sort of sad about my career in that I wasn't getting seen for West End stuff because I'd turned stuff down and I was off the circuit. I was just getting seen for less mainstream stuff. And we did this little tour of Macbeth and ended up actually at the Arts Theatre in the West End. And I adored every second of it, but was still feeling like I wasn't really doing what I should be doing. And actually, as it turned out, that was my big break, was meeting him and him then introducing me to Big Finish. I had no idea what any of it meant. He said, "Do you want to come and do a Doctor Who audio drama?" And I was like, "Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, okay." He said it was only one scene, or I think I did two scenes in, or one scene, I think, in Spectre of Lanyon Moore.
No, I think you died three times. you're three different characters.
Oh, I'm a Greek museum tour guide or something, aren't I?
You are.
Something like that.
And you're corporal, and I think you're someone else. I'm pretty sure you died three times.
Yeah. So the main thing is I was a hiker and I got killed within one scene. So that was my big break. And then I wrote to Gary Russell and I said, I absolutely loved every second of that. And I don't have any inhibitions about making a fool of myself. And I've got total vocal conviction. I can do lots of different voices. So use me however you want. And I was very fortunate because not many people knew about Big Finish then. So I was in this very small pool of actors that were up for it and keen and kind of in their consciousness. And so they used me for pretty much every alien that came along after that.
So that was you selling yourself to Gary Russell, but why did you love it?
Yes. Because for the same reason that most actors love it, it's spontaneous. It's instinctive. You don't have to rehearse. You don't have to learn lines. You get to meet amazing actors and everyone is full of joy to be there. And I love sci-fi. You know, I've always loved sci-fi and I love creating these extreme characters and pushing it to as far as I can go without someone saying, "Oh, no, can you tone it down a bit? It's not very RSC." You know, you've got license to really experiment and do silly things with your voice.
Did you know Doctor Who? You say you're a sci-fi fan. Were you a Doctor Who fan or not?
Yeah, I wouldn't describe myself as a fan. Really, although I've said I was a sci-fi fan, I love sci-fi, but I've never been a fan of anything. I mean, I just never had posters on my wall. I never was watching every episode of every series of anything. I just was eclectic and wanted to be interested in everything else. So, yeah, I did watch Doctor Who. Tom Baker was my doctor. A little bit of Pertwee before that. And, you know, I remember it changing into Tom later on. And then I did kind of watch it as we went through, but no, I was never a massive fan, and I'm certainly not aware of the canon in the way that most fans are. I usually have to check in with John Dorney or somebody else and say, "Oh, what noise did the TARDIS make in this era? I don't know."
Now, Kaza, you have a most beautiful voice. I mean, yours is one of those voices. You know, you could read the phone directory; it'd be lovely to listen to. And yet you managed to have so many different accents and voices. Where did all these different voices come from?
Well, again, I think it's to do with having a musical ear. If I hear an accent, then generally I can pick it up. I've been doing quite a lot of video game work in recent times, and that's quite a new thing for me. And they quickly cottoned on to the fact that I could do lots of different accents. And then a couple of times they'd send me an email the evening before the recording day and say, "Oh, can you just do this speech in a Dutch accent?" And I'd be like, "Well, I don't know. what a Dutch accent sounds like, but I'll listen to it on YouTube and yep, I'll be ready tomorrow. So yes, I had to learn Dutch and Hebrew at very short notice.
And you really can pick up accents just by listening to it, concentrating, yeah, and then doing it.
Yes, and I think some people can think about it in a quite an academic way, like, you know, all the vowel sound is a mixture of this sound and that sound. But for me, it's all about the what it sounds like.
Can we have a bit of your best Australian?
Well, that's really putting me on the spot because you are both over there and I don't think that's very fair because obviously I'm probably not going to get it completely right, but I'm going to do my darndest.
That's pretty
that's
good.
All you get. Well, it's not bad.
I'd like to say that's a bit of practice. I'd like to say it's not Australia, but it just sounds like one of our major politicians called Pauline Hanson. Which isn't good, but that's okay.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
Yeah, if you'd have said please explain, I would have been very frightened.
That's please explain.
Yeah, yeah.
Please explain to me how that can be the case. Is that it?
Yeah, we could take you on. She's a lovely totally right wing extreme.
Yeah,
politician.
She sounds like just my kind of woman.
Yeah, just a type of woman. Now, in 2001, you came back. Paul McGann did his first season with Big Finish, and there was kind of a repertoire of artists that were being used. So you were in three of the four productions.
Yes,
what was
right.
it like being part of new Doctor Who? Because this is 4 years before Doctor Who's come back on TV yet, and I think most people were feeling like this is canon and this is Paul McGann continuing as the Doctor. Did you have any sense of that vibe? And what was it like being in studio with Paul McGann rediscovering himself?
Yeah, I knew it was a big deal. And I knew that it had taken quite a lot to persuade Paul to give it a go. We all had to go and record in Bristol, which was closer to him. You know, it was all about making it feel great for him. And yes, I think he was quite, if I remember rightly, I think he was quite reserved at first, and then he warmed up as the recording days went on, as he got the measure of us and he got the measure of the work. And by the end, we were all having a right old laugh. I think there was Barnaby Edwards started a We Hate Helen a kind of thing for everyone to sign. I can't remember what prompted it. And Paul McGann had signed at the bottom of this list. Yeah, We Hate Helen. Let's get her out. It was that kind of vibe. It was everyone was winding everybody else up. And the whole thing was just so much fun, so much laughter, as always.
It's kind of like going on locations. You've all traveled to Bristol. So you're all staying together because it was all filmed. It was sort of filmed. It feels like films. It was all recorded over about 5 days. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I can't even remember where we stayed. It's all such a blur. I mean, it was such a long time ago, but I do remember I played, what was the name of the alien in the
It was the Triskeely.
Airship. The Triskeely, that's right. So the whole cast was in one studio and I was in a separate booth and having to have conversations with myself. The Doctor must die. No, don't kill the Doctor. And that felt absurd. But
I often think that a lot of what actors do, though, must feel absurd.
Yes.
I mean, I guess it's the reason why it was originally called plays, because it's just people being able to actually play on stage, wasn't it? Doing the most bizarre things.
I think the whole thing is playfulness. And I think it's really sad that people in kind of your normal, inverted commas, normal jobs don't get a chance to be playful. Because if you think about it, even if you move into adulthood and you're not a creative person, you definitely were as a child. You were making up stories, you were doing role play, you were making your toys play games and making up stories. And at some point down the line, most of us lose that playfulness. And people who are actors have pretty much said, oh, no, I like that bit. I'm just going to do that for the rest of my life. And that's the bit I love the most, is just being playful.
Now, one of the really great things, which isn't available at the moment, but hopefully will become available again sometime soon, is the Tomorrow People series that you did.
Yes.
Just in terms of how did they end up getting a lead? What become one of the leads in that series?
This is a story that people might have heard before, but I had to audition for it, actually, even though they'd heard me do loads of recordings by then. I had to audition, which I've never done before or since.
Who are you up against?
I don't know out there. They don't tell you those things. And the first recording day, because we used to record on Sundays, and we never do anymore, but we used to always record on a Sunday. And the first recording day was on my 30th birthday, the Sunday back then. And I, for the first time in my life, had booked a house down in Cornwall for all my friends, for me and my fiance, then fiance, and 8 of my friends. And I'd paid an absolute fortune for this blooming house. And so we went down on the Friday night, we had Saturday together, and then I flew back to, from Exeter Airport back to London on the Saturday night, so I could be there on Sunday for the recording. And I phoned everyone at this house. They were all still there and they all sang me happy birthday. And I sacrificed that day with them for the first recording of Tomorrow People. But my goodness, I'm glad I did, because it went on for 10 years, you know, 6 series over 10 years.
Yep. No, on that you have Louise Jameson played your mother. Is that the first time you got to meet her and start working with her?
No, I had met her a few years before that at a signing at 10th Planet Bookshop, 10th Planet Shop. And we sat next to each other and we signed CDs all afternoon. And then I'm sure we did a couple together of some other stories. It's all a blur. And then when she was going to come and play my mother, that was like, oh, that was really exciting. I wonder if it was the first time we'd recorded together. I don't know.
It's a bit hard to do the research on the Tomorrow People because it's all off the website because of
I know,
rights issues, the joys of rights.
Yes, indeed.
The two of you have a really special connection together, which is obvious when you act together. And it's then gone on to different plays. I know you've written a play which I've watched. I've seen her perform.
Yes.
Your play, Pulling Faces in Australia. She did it for us about 10 years ago.
I know. Amazing.
So, yeah, I'd love to see your work produced live. Why is the two of you click so well, do you think?
Oh, I think she is just one of the best human beings on the planet. She's just... in fact, I was talking to another actor who was full of admiration for her the other day, and we both said, oh, she's what I want to be when I grow up. She's just so aspirational because she's kind, she's talented, she's humble. She will do anything to help raise up other people, particularly women. You know, she'll try and create opportunities for talent. She's beautiful. she's just... And she's fun. Like, I think we laugh so much together. We've just got the same sense of humour. So we laugh till we cry whenever we're together. And that's really the secret of any good friendship or relationship, isn't it? We just have the same way of looking at the world. We direct in quite a similar way. We approach acting in quite a similar way. She's my spiritual sister. Yeah, I adore her.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting you mentioning your direction, because often, sometimes, trying to work out who's directed, whether it's your, because I don't look at the credits or anything. I put a story straight on. I try not paying attention to who's in or anything. I just listen along. And some, I often get confused in terms of, oh, is it you or Louise? Because both of you have, when you direct, you both love the sing-songness of vocalness. And so you bring out rhythm in actors in a way, and a singingness in actors. And so there's that style. That's it's interesting that both of you have that similar style. I mean, we talk about Lisa Bowman loves the pause, and she does. Yeah,
I love that.
You get pause. You get, it's very minimalistic, very little background music.
So
Lisa reduces everything down.
Okay.
Whereas there's a poetry that comes out in your direction, I think.
That's really interesting to hear. Yeah. Yes, I mean, in terms of the outcome, I don't, you know, I've never sort of listened to what Louise and I have done and judged it in that way. But when I've seen her directing, she directs in the same people-focused, encouraging way that I would. It's all about making the actor feel great and feel like they're doing a fabulous job, as opposed to some directors are all about the task. And so they're not necessarily as careful in the way they word their direction. You know, somebody might say, oh, don't do it like that. Do it like this. And I would never say, don't do it like that. And Louise is the same. It's all about developmental language and how do you want it to be rather than how you don't want it to be. So, is that a, yeah,
is that a
male
female thing?
No, could be, but for me, that's my nature, because as an actor, I know that's what I need and want, but also because I've done years and years of behavioral training in the corporate world, leadership training and communication training, and all the business models that I've worked with and learnt have been about encourage, inspire, motivate, have vision, you know, and how to give feedback in a way that feels developmental rather than critical. So that's all been really useful for me as a side, you know, a side career. It informed my directing, really.
Is it hard with the pressures of studio time, though? Because I mean, I guess, you know, ideally you want to say, would you like to try the different way to give it another opportunity, give it another chance, another shot at
would
us?
You like to try that in a better way?
I'd like what you've done, but do you like to explore? But how much pressure are you under with studio time to just pump it out?
It sort of depends on a lot of different factors. When we were recording remotely, it was very tricky because we had so many technical problems, problems with internet connection, problems with noises outside actors' houses, even though they had studios or they were buried in duvet. We could still hear the lawnmower or we could hear the plane going over. And lots of times we had massive delays. When we're all in studio, it's easier. I mean, I allocate 4 to 5 minutes per page when I'm doing my schedule. But if there's an actor that's brand new, I'll allocate more time, particularly at the start of the day, because I want them to feel like they've got time to relax into it and do it a few times. But generally, we would do 3 takes maximum. But occasionally, I'll go a bit more because I want someone to really feel happy with what they've done.
You said earlier that part of the reason you started writing was because there just weren't enough acting roles coming up and you needed to fill in your creative time. And I assume part of the reason you write is to actually make sure you give yourself parts, you know, something to produce down the track.
Yeah, I think it's more about that creative urge. It's, I always describe it as a tsunami of need to create. And being an actor, one of the worst, most awful, abysmal parts of it is that you're waiting for permission to do what you do, or to do the thing you've trained to do and to do the thing you've loved. You're waiting for some casting director to give you your outlet. And actually nowadays, there's no excuse to wait, because you can create your own stuff and put it on YouTube, or you can put it on one of these numerous platforms. But for me, writing was that I had all these ideas and all this creative energy and it had to come out somehow. And then I realized when I was writing that, of course, you are acting all of these parts in your head, and that felt very comfortable for me.
I think the first thing that you wrote that came was produced for Big Finish was Pulling Faces, which of course was
It was a Tomorrow People. I wrote a Tomorrow People episode called Stemming the Tide, set in the Shetland Isles.
So how did you get to be asked to write finally?
Well, I had been writing plays and sort of producing rehearsed readings of those for a few years. And Nigel Fairs knew that that's what I had been doing. And he might even have read, I think he'd read one of my plays. And so he just asked me, do you want to try and write one? And I said, all right, then I'll have a go. And I wrote twice as much as I should have written. It was way too long. I did loads of research about the Shetland Isles as well. I went full blast, typical me style, like did 100 times too much work. And then he very kindly edited it down for me. But yes, and I would always say this to aspiring writers as well, that if you write something, it doesn't matter if it doesn't get put on. A, you're honing your skills. B, you're giving yourself a creative outlet. C, something will always come of that endeavor. The energy that you've put into it will make something happen. It almost certainly won't be the thing you think is going to happen. Like your play isn't going to get picked up and put in the West End, but it might lead to somebody like Nigel Fairs reading it and saying, do you want to write a Big Finish? You know, or Louise, I wrote another play that she happened to read, and that's how I got to write Pulling Faces. So it's a calling card, you know, it's saying to people, yes, I'm committed. This is what I'm capable of. Let Me Write for You.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions, Drama Showcase, Pulling Faces.
Right. Well, I'd say you're a prime candidate for a full facelift.
Four margaritas. No, five. Oh, my God, no. Three slices of lemon drizzle cake.
I reckon that's brave, that is.
What is?
Well, letting people see how you really look. Knackered and crap like everybody else. Yeah, looking your age.
Apparently the producers thought you looked like you'd let yourself go a bit.
Ouch.
Well, Joanne, I think they have a point.
Rach tells me you're thinking of losing a few of those laughter lines.
We have a procedure where we make a small entry point here and suck the fat out via here, so the scarring is minimal.
But look, sweetheart, look at these. You wait till you get wrinkles and lines. They're awful.
No, they're not. They're a part of you.
Rachel, it's spare skin. I don't need this bit. Honest, I can live without it.
I would want to do an incision on the eyelid here as well to take out this excess skin, get rid of that droop.
I have a range of moisturiser that would suit your complexion perfectly. Oodles of hydration and would even out that skin tone, no end, but maybe you're right. It is a bit late to rescue some of the damage.
We can talk about a filler in the lips too, just to plump them up a little. How does that sound?
I feel sick. And selfish. And so ashamed.
Subscribers get more at bigfinish.com.
And Nigel is another one of those actors who writes to give himself parts, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. So he's so prolific. From. And he finds writing so easy compared to the rest of us, I think. He's in the same sort of league as John Dorney. You just give him a project and he'll run with it and probably finish it in a couple of weeks.
I'm not
he's
sure. Does any writer really find it easy? I think that they all bemoan how hard it is and being alone and how...
Comparatively easy. Comparative. Because I remember writing to emailing Nigel when I was doing another script for Big Finish. I think it was Escape Room, my Torchwood script. That was the first time I was back in writing with the intention of being a writer, you know, a regular writer. And I was so scared and so had such terrible imposter syndrome. And I emailed Nigel. I said, I don't know how to write a story. I don't even know where to start. What should I do? And I think he wrote something back like, oh, just get over yourself. Just write a story, mate. I don't think it was brilliantly helpful advice, but it just put it in perspective. Like, what are you panicking about? Just write a story.
Do you find yourself getting lost in the research because it's fascinating for you?
Yeah. I mean, I remember years ago, a friend of mine was in a Mike Lee film, Topsy Turvy, which was about Gilbert and Sullivan. And she was playing a real life character and she did months and months of research about this character. And I remember feeling really jealous and thinking, oh, I'd like an excuse to do some research into something. I'd like to be paid to research something. And so things like Attagirl and the Fourth Doctor episode that I wrote about Mary Anning, that was a lot of research. And also the one with, oh my God, I can't even remember what they're called anymore. The one with Churchill and the meddling monk. Subterfuge. Yeah, that was all a load of research, load of history. Yeah, so I mean, I really enjoy all of that. And I love looking things up online, like how do you make a bomb out of natural materials? The sort of thing that gets you put on a list, a blacklist. I love being able to Google stuff like that. We're so lucky that I don't have to go and do it all at the library now.
Do you know how long it took you to do your first script compared to now when you do a story?
Yeah, I think it took me about 3 months, that first Stemming the Tide. And then the next few took me, a good couple, 2 or 3 months. Because you're not writing continuously, you're kind of writing bits and bobs and spreading it out and going away and crying periodically, saying, I can't do it. But recently I had to write a script that shall be nameless because it hasn't been announced yet. I had left it to the last minute because I was directing so much and I was so overwhelmed with work. And I thought, oh, it's all right. It's 10,000 words. I've got a clear month before I go off and do this other contract, Clearmonth. And then I went to sign the contract and I realised it was 20,000 words. And it was like the bars of a prison coming round me. I thought, oh, actually, I'm just going to be writing 8 hours a day for a month. And that's what I did, you know. And it's probably one of the best scripts I've ever written because it was under pressure and that was all I could do was write. Yeah.
When you say that you were overwhelmed with directing work, you're probably talking about the amount of work. But
yeah,
when you started directing The Ninth Doctor with Christopher Eccleston, was that a different mm-hmm. kind of overwhelm and concern that you yes. had with directing him? Tell us about that experience.
Well, I was never overwhelmed about directing him because I'm, as I say, I don't really register the fact that it's someone that well known. It was only when I met him, we did one series remotely and we had good rapport and we really sort of sparked off each other. And then when I met him face to face, I was like, oh, you're a star. You know, I hadn't really felt it until I felt the kind of charisma of him in person. And the size of him, I hadn't expected him to be, you know, this quite big physical presence in the room. But really, the pressure is because of his lack of availability, because he's so busy. We then have to, the lead up to those recordings is very short. So I have to read the scripts, prep the scripts, cast the scripts in a very short time scale. And that's a huge amount of pressure. And it's always like that. So obviously we've done loads of them now and every time we do it, it's just unrelenting. I've got to do to get this signed off because otherwise we're not going to be ready to record.
Well, anytime you need a Tasmanian in a hurry, I'm right here. I know you got Adam Martin through a podcast. I'm just putting my hand up too.
I know. Wasn't that fantastic? I love how popular his character is. And he was so brilliant. I mean, really one of the best that I've worked with. And it was pure chance. It was only because we were being very kind of careful and politically appropriate about casting someone who was vision impaired. And I knew that Adam was, and I knew he was a trained actor with some professional experience. So I'd listened to his demo and I thought, yeah, it's good. It's really good. So we invited him. Did we audition him? No, I think I just gave him the part on a gamble, really. And then he came in and he blew me away. The preparation and the instinct and the subtext behind it. It was really an exceptional performance. So I was so thrilled for him.
I mean, the other Australian you've recently worked with was Rowan McManus as well.
Yes. I mean, that was all very unexpected. But evidently, he's very big over there, isn't he?
He's huge.
Yeah, but he's also a massive Doctor Who fan. So, and he recorded all in the night. You know, we didn't change the timing of the recording for everyone else. He just joined us at a time that was appropriate for the rest of us. So he was, you know, he was so determined to be in it.
Great. Yeah, we just talked to him about that actually, because when he found out we had Janet in Hobart, he checked his calendar, so he flew in to do interviewing. So.
Oh, wow.
So we had a chance to talk to him. He's a major Doctor Who nerd.
I know. I just hope he loved being in it. I think he did.
Yes, well, he wants to be the Sixth Doctor. No, that was the Sixth Doctor. He wants to do Eighth Doctor as well. Just
does he? Oh, okay.
Those two Doctors, he's pushing Jason Hagel for the other job as well.
Well, you know, nothing wrong with pushing. That's how the business works.
Yeah. Beginning role play now.
From Big Finish Productions, The Worlds of Doctor Who, The Robots, Volume 6.
Hi. No. Yes. Two of you.
Yeah.
Siblings can be so different. Nature versus nurture.
You can't trust anyone round here. There are weird things going on.
Hi there. Good morning. Good morning. That's definitely not what this is. There's two of me, too.
Oh, well, this is awkward.
It seems terrorist activity has recommenced.
She She's a robot duplicate.
Well, one of you is.
Rollout has been scheduled.
Look at today. This could be it. The uprising.
D-770 to D-780. Designated security duty.
The DOMs are the worst. Dead eyes. Always watching you.
D-781 and D-782. Designated maintenance. Follow.
Impatience runs in the family.
They're not alive.
That all depends on your definition of life.
Species? You're not a species.
They've been evolving.
There is no override.
You are leaving today, right?
Oh, you won't be leaving this building alive, Chenka.
Liv! She's got a squadron of dumbs!
Big Finish. For the love of stories.
We all have somewhere that we came from, even if it's somewhere we need to run away from.
Hello, my name's Nigel Fairs, and this is The Sirens of Audio.
Can I say, I think I mentioned, I tweeted recently just in terms of listening to the robots, the final box
set. Oh,
yes. And your story in that, The Force of Nature, is just, the three stories are spectacular. Like, it's
yeah,
the
they're
best
all, they're
ending.
Great.
Ending the box set, but your one that kicks it off is just, I was thinking it's maybe what my favourite script of yours. Attica Girl probably still wins because it still makes me cry. But in terms of Doctor Who stuff, it's just an amazing script, and the way you've captured characters and just the scenes on, yeah, no spoilers. but yeah, it's really such a great script. And the fact that
Thank you.
Scripts are so different together, it just makes it such a tight box set.
Well, I have to really pay tribute to John Dorney, who is such a genius and is so supportive, and he was so patient with me, because I was overwhelmed with that script, because the backstory and the political detail and the complexity of the world that they've created in robots was just too much information for me to take in. I had to keep reading and rereading the Bible. We call it the Bible, where when you've got all the history of all the what's come before, and I just couldn't get my head around who supports what, you know, the Sons of Kaldor and the this and the that. And yeah, John had to really help me through with that. And they're very kind to me at Big Finish, because they know that keying into a series like that with my limited time as well, where I can't listen, I don't have time to listen to all that's gone before. They're very good at giving me standalone stories that have connected strands. And John really helped me massively with the connected strands of that one.
It also just released is The Rani Takes on the World. So you've got to direct the new Rani series. What was it like working with those? Well, I was going to say young actors, they're a bit older now.
Yes, they're younger than me.
Bringing back all those characters.
It was so joyful. I mean, that's one of my favourites for sure. I mean, Anjali and Danny are just a joy to be around. And I can't really find enough superlatives for the privilege of working with people like that. Talented, charming, making sure everybody else is comfortable. The scripts are phenomenal. Emily Cook, who of course has moved on to other things now because she's such a driving force as a producer, she has created something so, so special and so full of love and fandom, and it really ticks all the boxes, I think. And people are starting to comment on it now and saying how much they love it. And I'm so, so lucky to have been part of that project.
I know Anjali has been in plenty of Big Finish over the years, but was that Daniel's? I think was that only his second appearance in Big Finish, or has he done others as well?
I don't think he's done that many, if any.
I can only think of one other that he did years ago.
Okay, yeah, it felt like quite a fresh thing for him, and but of course he took to it like a duck to water. I mean, he's such a natural. And he's a natural comedian for sure, in and out of the studio. Great sort of energy about him.
Now, the biggest thing to be coming out of Big Finish this year, coming up leading up to the 60th anniversary, is the whole Once and Future series, of which you have had the pleasure of directing all of them.
No, it's me and Ken Bentley.
You and Ken Bentley share them?
Yeah. Is it 8 episodes altogether? Or 10? I can't remember.
I was going to say, what can you tell us that we can expect? What are we looking forward to?
You can expect incredible guest stars. You can expect epic storylines. I've just listened to one of them yesterday. I signed off on the music edit, and it is epic. It's like, it makes you feel, oh, something massive is happening here. And yeah, I mean.
Now, Howard Carter, does he do the music for all of them?
Howard Carter, who really is our equivalent of Hans Zimmer. His instinct for it is second to none. He can do it. He can turn it around in a day. You'd send him some drama and he'll just key into the feeling of every scene. And just, it's so rare that I have to give a note on the music to Howard. It's usually I sit and do my crocheting. I'll show you. I listen and I'm working my way through a blanket. So I can sit and listen and sort of keep my hands occupied. But yeah, I mean, what an incredible talent he is.
Is he doing the sound design as well?
He's doing sound and music, yeah.
One thing that I always remember about Howard was one story he did a couple of years back called Return to Skaro. And as a fan, yeah. The sound design in that was incredible. Do you remember that, Philip? He got the sounds. It was like it was back in the 1960s. And if this is a celebration of all things Doctor Who, the 60th anniversary, I'm really looking forward to what he can do, not just with the music, but with the sound too, to take us all back. It'd be good.
Oh, it is amazing, yeah.
So according to the website, you still have 15 more productions already lined up and named to come out until the end of the year.
Yeah. So, well, that's a brilliant thing, because this year I had 3 weeks off. I had 3 weeks in March where I'd signed off on the last thing. For the first time in 2 years, I didn't have anything hanging over my head. I was like, oh my God, I've cleared my list of things to do. And then I had 3 weeks where nobody contacted me. I had no emails. Nobody wrote back to me. Nobody phoned me. Nobody left me a message. I was like, oh, is it over? Is this the end? Yeah. And then the edits started coming in, because obviously I've just directed so many last year. Now the edits are coming in. So instead of having to go to the studio and direct, I can sit at home and do my crocheting and listen to the edits. And that's how I'm earning my living for the next few weeks. So that's a great position to be in. That's the first time that's really happened, where it's just edits.
So as you look back at what you've done for Big Finish so far, what are the couple of things that you just sort of say, yeah, they're the special moments?
Attagirl, for sure. That will always be something that I'm so incredibly proud of.
Any chance of a story number 3 season coming out?
I don't know. I doubt it, because unfortunately, you know, Big Finish has this incredibly loyal listenership. But it is more about the science fiction and the Doctor Who connected stuff. You know, our originals arm, I think it would take quite a big, expensive campaign to get the kind of audience that we would need to kind of make them really profitable.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's an expensive business making an audio drama. And if you're not going to make enough profit, then it's hard to justify all the work that goes into it.
Yeah, can I say, Attagirl will still make the most amazing TV series. I can't believe.
I'm pretty sure it. I think it is going to be one. I think just before lockdown, it had been optioned by one of the actresses from Game of Thrones. She'd started her production company, and they'd optioned to do something about that theme. And so I'm sure it will come out eventually. I'm sure there will be one.
But Louise
and I were in talk.
It wasn't called Attagirl. No, it was something. It was it was set around that
women
scenario,
like
but
that.
It was different.
Yeah. But Louise and I were in discussion with a production company at one point, and then it was the usual thing. You know, they said go away and write an 8-part treatment for a Netflix series, and we were like, okay, so where's the commission money for that? And no, there's no money. There's no money in this speculative treatment that you're going to spend months writing. And just the whole vibe of it just didn't feel right. It was too uncertain. I think when we're that busy, we just couldn't justify it.
So Attagirl, what are the, some of the other highlights?
Attagirl, Ninth Doctor has been so wonderful from start to finish. I love working with Chris. I love working with David Richardson. I love all the people that want to work with Chris. I love the scripts. I think the scripts are exceptional. Every day working on that is full of fun and laughter and depth and excitement. So I'm so lucky to be at the helm of that. I never in a million years dreamt that that would be me. You know, during lockdown, I said to David Richardson, so did we manage to pin anyone down, you know, that we wouldn't normally have got because people are a bit more available? And he went, no, that's not happened. And then literally like a couple of days later, there was an announcement that Chris was going to be doing recordings. And David emailed me, he said, oh, I'm so sorry, I had to lie to you. It was my non-disclosure agreement. I wasn't allowed to tell you. And by the way, do you want to direct them? So that was all a bit of a, whoa, okay.
Instant forgiveness.
I said, good, he lied to you. Yeah. Maybe he felt guilty so he asked to do it.
Yeah, maybe that's why. It's nothing to do with my talent.
Well, listen, Helen, thank you so much for the years of joy you've brought us both in front and behind the microphone.
My pleasure.
And we have months and months of more joy coming. Looking forward to seeing, looking forward to the whole 60th anniversary and what you're going to bring us there. And looking forward to seeing further creative writing as well, because your scripts I adore, and I love your writing.
Thank you.
And looking forward to many more exciting stories.
Yes, there are some coming. Spoilers.
I'm the Doctor. This is Callan Lennox. How can we help?
Doctor Who, the Ninth Doctor Adventures, Pioneers.
Have you noticed the sky's all wrong?
We have travelled to the edge of known space. We are now returning.
The gift won't be given in our lifetime. We all accept that.
Danger, Callan! Danger!
And what gift would that be, exactly?
Everything around you. All the treasures from old Earth. We carried them to the stars and kept them safe. The grubs roam free most of the time.
It's got teeth like a fox! Stinks of mould and hunger.
Oh, come on, give me some good news. Collision course? What? What are you doing in Fritjof Nansen Land? What? Fritjof Nansen Land? The place Nansen and Hjalmar Johansson spent the winter on their way back from trying to reach the North Pole. Hence, the name.
What are you talking about? I'm Fritjof Nansen.
Oh, it's going to get in here, isn't it?
Chin up. The night is darkest before the dawn.
Yeah, but how dark are we talking?
I'm telling you, you're wasting your time with those things.
Maybe we are, but you don't know that for a fact. Indeed, it seems to me you know little more than we do.
This is Manchester, 1888, the Royal Hotel.
Yes.
So now I just need to know which room. The records were a bit vague on that score. Score!
Do you need some brandy and a lie down, sir?
It means the meeting of the football men.
What was that thing?
That was a strike.
What's a strike?
Creature from another world.
American?
Ah! Hold still a moment.
I am the totality.
Totally. And I'm the Doctor. And I'm the Doctor. And I'm the Doctor.
Big Finish, for the love of stories.
Philip, can I just reiterate what I said before, that I think Helen is one of the biggest unsung heroes of Big Finish.
Yeah, I fully agree. Just love her. And you know, we just scratched the surface of stuff she'd done then. And yeah, could easily go for hours more, and we will definitely get her back sometime in the future to still talk some more. Love to talk more about her writing and some of her other passions as well.
Yep. So, I mean, the bulk of her work with Big Finish now is directing, but I don't think we even, did we mention during the interview, Monsters in Metropolis? She had an amazing acting part in there that just blew me away. Incredible. So she's got, not only can she do the screamy death scenes, the singing, she can also do incredible acting of drama as well. She can do it all. Yeah. She's probably the most versatile, one of the most versatile people they've got.
Fully agree. All right. Yeah, very thankful for her time with us.
Yep. All right. That will do us for the Sirens of Audio for this instalment. It's been lovely to have your company, Philip.
Oh, and lovely to have you too, Dwayne.
I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. I'm not going to be hopping up to Sydney for the next few months doing anything with you in person.
You'll work it out. You'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm sure. I've got to get through the Tassie winter. All right. Here we go. All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We will catch you all next time.
Bye.
This has been the Sirens of Audio, episode 154, with our guest Helen Goldwyn and your hosts Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Original theme music composed by Joe Kramer. Our website is sirensofaudio.com. Comment below to let us know what you thought of the episode, or contact us via email at sirensofaudio@gmail.com or any one of our socials. Thanks for listening, audiophiles. We'll hear you next time.